Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. By now, many of you have heard that on Monday, a very famous incarcerated man was released from prison after more than two decades.
The crowd swarmed Adnan Syed outside a Baltimore circuit court.
A judge in Baltimore has overturned the murder conviction of Adnan Syed, who was convicted in the 1999 murder of his high school classmate, Haemin Lee.
You might not recall that name at first, but if you are an avid podcast listener, actually, even if you're not, his story may sound familiar.
This is a global tell link. That's a call from
Adnan Syed.
It's not the first time media attention has sparked new scrutiny of a wrongful conviction and even overturn it. In 2019, James Chad Lewis Clay had his conviction overturned after a report from the Detroit Free Press. In 2020, a Georgia man named Dennis Perry was freed from prison after 20 years with the help of local reporter Joshua Sharp and a podcast called Undisclosed, about which more in a few minutes. That same year, charges were dropped against accused murderer Curtis Flowers after being featured on season two of the In the Dark podcast. But in 2014, we, by which I mean countless millions worldwide, took the time to download, tune in, and listen to Adnan Syed's story on Serial. We got to know Adnan, his family, his friends, and weigh in on whether he was guilty of murdering his ex-girlfriend, Haemin Lee.
Okay, so do you think Adnan's guilty?
Oh!
I think he had something to do with it, but I don't think he should have been in prison.
I don't know for sure. We can talk about this all day.
No, I think he's innocent, completely. I think he had nothing to do with it.
Baltimore's chief prosecutor, Marilyn Mosby, currently facing federal charges for fraud and perjury, that's another story, was committed to reviewing the sentences of minors convicted of crimes.
This act allows people convicted of crimes as juveniles to request a modification of sentence after they have served more than 20 years incarceration. Mr. Syed qualified because he spent more than 22 years. Becky Feldman subsequently led nearly a year-long exhaustive investigation.
She reviewed Syed's files and found enough holes and omissions in the prosecution's case to prompt a judge to overturn his conviction. Some of those discrepancies and omissions were exposed by investigations after the release of Serial. But it wasn't happy news for everyone.
While Adnan Syed's family, friends, and supporters celebrate his release, as you just heard, the family of murder victim Haemin Lee say the new developments are, and I quote, a living nightmare.
Rabia Chaudhry is an attorney, author, podcaster, and criminal justice reform advocate who spent much of the last 23 years working to get her friend Adnan Syed out of prison. And when it finally happened,
it felt a little bit like a dream sequence. There was something about that entire day, Monday, when we left the courthouse that was so familiar. And I realized it was because it was exactly how I had hoped and envisioned it for many years. I was in the courtroom in 2000 when he was convicted. That day is just burned in my memory. And about a month later, I found the alibi witness who was never presented in court, and I got an affidavit from her. And for years, I just took that affidavit around trying to get somebody's attention, like, this should be enough to get him a new trial, that nobody examined his alibi witness. His attorney greatly failed in this. But, you know, we went through the appellate process, the direct appeals, then a post-conviction. By the time we got the hearing, it was a couple of years later. I testified there. The alibi witness did not show up. That's when I realized it seemed like we were not going to get good justice in the courts. And I had been a longtime watcher of Dateline and, you know, these kinds of shows. And I thought, let me just get a journalist to look at this. Maybe the journalist can find something that we have not been able to find. And I reached out to Sarah Koenig because her name came up when I did a quick search of anybody who had written about Adnan or his attorney or Baltimore crime in 1999. And she had worked for the Baltimore Sun then.
Mm-hmm. She was working at This American Life.
Right. I thought this would turn maybe into a one-hour This American Life episode. I had no idea they were going to make a podcast, and I had no idea what a podcast was, frankly.
Were you shocked? Was he, when the series took off like a rocket?
Oh, immediately. I mean, the very first day that it launched, it aired 2 episodes and my phone just blew up. Calls from people I knew. They're like, is this you? From media. I mean, like, it was an instant sensation. And I don't think anybody in the Serial team expected that either. Yeah, it was crazy.
Serial came out in 2014. It was a new way to use a new medium that ultimately revolutionized the radio industry. It offered a long and intimate look into the thinking of the reporters and the producers and the process as they tried to unwind Hayes' murder and Adnan's case.
I've been on TV before, like, you know, on Dateline or Nightline, where someone tries to reenact the crime.
Adnan on the prison phone to Serial.
There's a moment where, like, there's someone like, you know what, this crime could not have been committed according to these set of facts. There's, like, always this moment, right? The route, it's just, I don't know. Oh, hey, we're getting ready to go, right? Sorry. All right, bye.
Okay, bye.
That happens sometimes. The guards come by and you're just done, mid-sentence. Anyway, I can pick up from Adnan's letter. He wrote that in addition, the route to the Best Buy, even though it's close to the school, there are major intersections along the way and that there is, quote, a ton of traffic at that time, unquote. And then the murder itself. How would he be able to strangle Hay, a tall, strong, athletic girl, quote, remove her body from the car, carry it to the trunk and place her in there in broad daylight at 2:30 in the afternoon? And then I walk into the Best Buy lobby and call Jay and tell him to come meet me there? All in 21 minutes. I am 100% sure that if someone tried to do it, it would be impossible, unquote. Gauntlet So Thrown, producer Dana Chivas and I gave it a shot.
It was downloaded hundreds of millions of times and reached listeners around the world. It launched podcasting as a medium, especially the true crime medium we're all so familiar with that it became an easy target for satire.
The true crime podcast, I saw it.
Police brought back the bike, but not the boy. Bike, but no boy. Because the boy was dead. Blue Apron. Don't have time to cook.
It launched so many other podcasts, which were examining this case. It also brought resources to me, two attorneys who I began working with to investigate the case. The thing is, Serial was an incredible narrative and interesting storytelling. But throughout the series, it was very difficult for me to really enjoy it because there was misreporting. Out of frustration, I began blogging, not to malign the podcast, but to kind of add more to where I thought there was a lot of holes. And these other two attorneys were also blogging. And so then we just teamed up and people said, your blogs are great. Nobody's reading them. Start your own podcast. That's how people want to hear the story. In fact, the motion that was filed last week that helped release Adnan included evidence that these two attorneys found and we reported on Undisclosed years ago.
What was that evidence?
That the cell phone tower evidence was completely junk science and faulty. And my colleague, Susan Simpson, who's an attorney, is the one who discovered this fax cover sheet. And I still have the email she sent to me and said, Rabia, do you realize this fax cover sheet has this one line that says that this information cannot be used to track location on the cell phone?
Mm-hmm. And yet the initial prosecutors used this information to help convict Adnan.
Well, I mean, look, the murder took place in 1999, and cell phone technology was very new then. This might have been the first case in Maryland that revolved around some cell phone technology as evidence. There was no GPS tracking then, but, you know, your cell phones would ping off of towers. But sometimes if the tower wasn't available, it would ping off another tower. And the prosecutors argued that these pings were like a map. The problem, of course, even in that case, even if those pings were accurate, is those pings covered, let's say, a radius about 3 miles around the tower. But they argued that there were pings that covered where the burial ground was, which is true, but those were also the same radius in which one of the state's witnesses lived, the school, the mosque was in that area. Everything happened in such close proximity, it was impossible to pinpoint where the phone would be. But, you know, it kind of wowed the jury, right? You had the CSI effect going on, yeah. Too. They're like, oh, this is like real forensic evidence, except it wasn't. And so last week, the state capitulated and said, it's junk science. It didn't work. The second thing the state capitulated on last week was that the state's witness was completely unreliable. My colleague, Susan Simpson, did an incredible job lining up his changing statements. Every time something new would arise in the police investigation day by day, Jay Wiles, the state's witness, would have to change his story to match it. When you read the transcript, it's hard to understand what's happening in the interrogation room with this witness. When you listen to the recording, Jay would say something, there would be a knocking sound on a table, like somebody's alerting him. He would say, sorry, sorry, and he would start over.
What happens then? We leave there, I believe. Can you bear with me for a minute? Okay, we left there. I took him back to school and I dropped him off.
Did you catch that? Jay's responding to someone after that pause. And not just that. There's a tap, tap. And then Jay says, oh, okay. And suddenly, a moment later, he knows the answer.
This was the only eyewitness.
And then, you know, another thing in the motion that the state filed last week, the track record of one of the lead detectives. At the time Serial aired, that detective had been sued numerous times for coercing witnesses to lie in other innocence cases. So people who were exonerated got out and sued this detective. And, you know, when Sarah Koenig said in Serial, well, these were just good guys doing their jobs, I immediately sent her links to those lawsuits. And I said, they have a pattern of misconduct.
Principally, you're talking about Detective William Ritz.
Ritz. Mm-hmm. The state said that those are detectives with a history of misconduct. They coerce witnesses. And that's how we ended up with Jay Wilds and his crazy statements.
Right.
The state cited that in their motion last week. And, you know, a lot of people thought that I was somehow involved in producing the show. I had no idea what was going to be reported week by week. And when I would listen, I would also always be stressed out, like, what else are they going to report that's going to undermine, you know, our defense of Adnan? And these things did, frankly. And what I really would just hope is for them to say, we got some things wrong. Here's some corrections. And that's it. And in the time since Serial, so much more evidence has been discovered. More evidence that was cited in the motion last week actually came from the HBO documentary. And the prosecutor talked about this evidence from the documentary.
Your documentary.
I executive produced it, but Amy Berg, the director, gets the credit for the investigation there. There was just so much more work that had to be done in the last 7 years. But we're still grateful for the attention and the resources Serial brought to the case.
Right. You're grateful for what Serial did. You're frustrated with what Serial did. I guess you've never called them?
Well, because of my experience during the reporting of Serial, I tried. In real time, I tried. And they would not take any feedback. In fact, they would get upset. But, you know, I don't want to, like, keep getting bogged into this. The issue with Serial is that nobody has reach like Serial. If they don't correct their record, people can continue to know the case, right?
On the other hand, you've also noted that Serial and Sarah Koenig taught you a lot about how to present a story.
Oh, look, what Serial taught all of us is that people have an appetite for long-form investigative reporting, and people have the attention span to listen to it. And so we were able to do like 20-odd episodes on Adnan's case in my show, and people listen to it. Also that, you know, storytelling can change people's minds. A lot of times where facts and figures fail, storytelling is much more powerful.
Of course, storytelling imposes limitations. You've noted that a journalistic endeavor, a podcast, say, differs from a legal investigation, although both should share the goal of getting to the truth. But storytelling, especially audio storytelling, requires a kind of linear approach. And there's so much that you need to parcel out slowly because people can't go up the page and recheck something you just said. Did you feel a deeper understanding of the process and its limitations when you undertook your own endeavors? The podcast, the HBO documentary, the book.
Yeah. You know, look, maybe because I am an attorney and I was working with other attorneys on the podcast, we, especially with the first season, actually many seasons after that, we just kind of decided that if it took 18 episodes to really unpack a case and give it its due, we were going to take 18 episodes. We were approached by other defendants. We were approached by Innocence Projects, by families of people who are incarcerated saying, can you take a look at our case? We ended up doing 24 cases. You know, later down the line, we would be like, well, okay, we really need to figure out how to pack it into 12 episodes, let's say, or 14, like limit it somehow. But even then, the investigative part was front and center. We don't have the kind of storytelling abilities that Serial has, or even the incredible production quality and the beautiful audio editing, but we focus on what we think is important for the defendant to prove this defendant's innocence.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned storytelling ability. Part of it is when you provide a piece of information, when you build a sense of suspense, all of these things without distorting the story, hopefully, or without too much audience manipulation, maybe just a little to keep them excited. Did you attempt any of that, or you saw your thing as a kind of public record?
You know, we've done our best to try to incorporate stronger storytelling techniques in our reporting just to keep the audience engaged by doing things like, for example, at the end of every episode, kind of leaving with a little bit of a cliffhanger, doing things like after credits, having some outtakes and things like that. You know, we learned some as we moved along. But look, frankly, our first few episodes dropped and we got some absolutely vicious reviews about how terrible the quality was and all that, because we were like, all of us were sitting in our closets, the three of us, and, you know, just trying to lay out evidence. The thing about Serial is, you know, and I was talking to my husband about it the other day, and it's so complicated for me. And I said to him, I said, what if somebody told an amazing story that brought tons of attention to you and support for you, but so much of it was wrong? Where on the scale of appreciation should you be, right?
Adnan is presented as a really good, really relatable guy in your series and in Serial. You've observed that, you know, people saw him now, older, with a white kippah, as I would call it, you know.
The Muslim equivalent of a kippah.
Yeah, yeah, and bearded that, you know, after years of conditioning, so to speak, there might be a reflex to recoil. Do you think that Serial's reporting helped take away some of that stigma that Adnan might have suffered? And does the coverage in other places report on the communities appropriately?
Right. That is one thing I think Serial gets all the credit for, that they were able to humanize American Muslims and our experience and just who we are as people in a way that I don't know if any media has ever done before, frankly, ever. We can argue about like whether things were better for Muslims before 9/11, but in 1999, when Adnan was convicted, his religion and national origin and race were brought up over 300 times at his trial. And the stereotypes were used against him. There's been lots of reports about the image of Muslims in media and how for 100 years in Hollywood, especially Muslim men, they've always been portrayed as misogynist and violent against women and all these things, and women are submissive. Or they're belly dancers, right? It's one or the other. And so the beauty of the podcast medium was that people got to hear my voice, my brother's voice, Adnan's voice. They had no idea what we look like. You know, and I wonder if it was a visual medium, if the story would have been received differently. I really do.
I think you're right, because when This American Life went to television, Ira Glass has said that one reason why it didn't work as well is because visuals separate audiences from the subjects or from the characters, whereas voices are so intimate, like the breath on your cheek, and it brings them so much closer.
I think the fact that people got to know us through our personalities and voices before they got to see what we look like made a huge difference. So yeah, I do think on that front, Serial was incredibly powerful, and I don't know if there's ever been any media like it before.
Obviously, Rabia had some things to say about Serial, so we invited Serial to respond. Sarah Koenig wrote this: I have enormous admiration for Rabia for all kinds of reasons, but our missions are different. She's an advocate, I'm a reporter. I made editorial decisions she didn't agree with. She made public statements I didn't agree with. During the making of the podcast, I welcomed information from anyone and everyone, and especially from Rabia. She provided crucial help, and from looking back just now through our texts and emails from 2014 and 15, I see we were exchanging information pretty regularly. After that, I don't see any emails or texts from Rabia to me or to the Serial staff alerting us to more information or asking for episode updates. Regarding Detective Bill Ritz, it's not correct that we resisted information about his reputation. At the time we aired, Ritz had been named in only one relevant lawsuit, not multiple lawsuits, and that lawsuit had been dismissed. Because we didn't know the strength of the allegations against him, we chose to focus instead on the questionable work he did in Adnan's case. We pointed out that during his taped conversations with Jay, the state's main witness, Ritz seemed to be inappropriately pulling Jay toward a narrative that would align with cell phone records, the only other real evidence they had about that night. We engaged an expert in police interrogations, and he, too, on serial, expressed suspicion of the way Jay was questioned by the detectives, because too much was happening off tape, undocumented. The expert also noted detectives never searched Jay's house or submitted him to a polygraph, possibly to avoid encountering evidence that contradicted their theory. It's also not accurate that we haven't covered important developments in Adnan's case. We have. When the news came out in 2015 that Abe Waronowitz, the state cell phone expert, had recanted his testimony, we wrote an extensive blog post on our website about what that meant for Adnan's case. When that issue finally made its way into court in 2016, we covered it. We made three new follow-up episodes in which we discussed the cell phone testimony at length. Those episodes were released on the serial feed and posted on our website for the next 6 years. When the state finally conceded that the cell phone evidence was unreliable, on September 19th, we reported that too. I want to make clear that I've always thought that we kick-started the process of getting Adnan's case more attention. I have never, then or now, considered the story we did on Serial as definitive. As others have found out more, I've cheered on that new information and given credit where credit is due. And Rabia and her team deserve a lot of credit. Coming up, the latest chapters in the stories of Adnan Syed, Rabia Chaudhry, and Haman Lee. This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. In 2019, HBO presented a documentary in four parts called The Case Against Adnan Syed, produced by Rabia Chaudhry. Her closeness to both the family and the case, her relentless pursuit of irrefutable, exonerating evidence, made her part of the story. And of course, so were Adnan's family and friends, and his accusers. And so also were Haman Lee and her friends, and glimpses of her family, too. This part of the interview also has some actual news. One of the things you did in the HBO series that I so admired was to really give voice to Haman Lee. It was enormously lucky that she kept a diary and that Amy Berg found what I can only hope was the right kind of voice to read it.
This book is open to those whose heart is innocent. If you feel any guilt reading this, you should stop.
It really placed her at the center of the tale with Adnan for as long as it could.
Dedicated to those who I love and love me back. Do love and remember me forever, since I'll always love you all.
Yeah, you know, when I saw that first episode, it just left me weeping and just reeling because, you know, when Amy found this narrator that she thought would work, she checked with Hay's friends and they said, this sounds like Hay. You know, seeing Hay come to life, but also seeing Adnan come to life and seeing them both as like, you know, high school kids, Amy brought them both back to life in that time. And it still gives me goosebumps. It has been so hard to give Haman Lee voice. And I thought that was a brilliant decision on her part.
At the most recent hearing, Haman Lee's younger brother said, this isn't a podcast for me. It's a nightmare.
Yeah.
Have you spoken with the Lee family?
Look, we have never spoken to the Lee family because for us to reach out would be really inappropriate. It could look like we are somehow pressuring them or intimidating. It's just a bad idea to do it. However, me and others have publicly said many times, if they wanted to reach out, our doors are always open. We would love to sit down and go through the case with them, go through the evidence that multiple different investigators have found. You know, I met with the state's attorney, Marilyn Mosby, me, Adnan's mother, and his brother on Monday before the hearing. And at that meeting, I said to her, do you have a liaison with the Lee family? I know how difficult this is going to be for them. I mean, I don't personally know, but I can't imagine. I said, do you have a liaison that you can reach out to them and say, listen, we're here to talk. Also, let them know that we, us family, people who are close to Adnan, are here to talk. And she said they did. They had a program, they had a process, but the victim's family had to decide whether they wanted to be part of it.
Mm-hmm. Sarah Koenig tried to contact the family, and she couldn't either. There was something that you said in the documentary that I feel bears repeating, that clinging to Adnan as the perpetrator denies Hay justice. You know, there's a rape kit that maybe should be tested. There's DNA that was never really followed up on, a bunch of objects and a couple of names. Is there any hope that Hay's case can be reopened for real by people who go on a track that does not automatically fall on the easy to accuse ex-boyfriend?
Yeah, you know, a lot of times in these kinds of cases, when there is an exoneration, you know, I've been involved in so many now, the state will just decline to investigate further. They literally just close the case and move on. And it's really traumatic for the family. There's no closure for the victim. There's also, in many ways, no closure for the person who is exonerated because they don't even know whose crime they serve time for, right? This case is different. The state's attorney has announced that they have an active homicide detective team investigating the case. There is still outstanding DNA. Beyond the DNA, there's other evidence. I can tell you this, the things that they've told us about the suspects they're looking at in the motion is probably a fraction of the evidence they've actually gathered. I actually anticipate that there will be an arrest in this case, probably before the end of the year.
Wow. There was a book, a huge podcast, a less huge podcast, a documentary, lots of pressure and goodwill. But none of them freed Adnan. They don't make those decisions. So what did?
What made the difference in this case is that this is a state's attorney who already has established a track record of prioritizing exonerations and sentence justice reform. State's Attorney Marilyn Mosby years ago established a sentencing review unit and a conviction integrity review unit, which look at people who were sentenced too harshly and that look at people who might be innocent. She's only one of two prosecutors in the entire state of Maryland that has done this, and one of very few, a handful maybe across the country, maybe a dozen. She's already exonerated 12 people. And the sentencing review unit, she hired an attorney named Becky Feldman, who worked with the public defender's office, who is very familiar with the kinds of police and prosecutorial misconduct that occurred in this case. And when our attorney approached Attorney Feldman to say maybe Adnan could get resentenced, if nothing else, under this new law, she took a look at this case a year ago and started investigating. She was the one who came back and said, resentencing might not be justice for Adnan because I think this might be an innocence case. And nobody could have predicted that.
Two last questions. One each about Adnan and Hay. You mentioned that it's possible that Hay's case could be resolved within a year.
Within this year.
Within this year. I've heard tell of a possible suspect or two.
There are two suspects who were named in the motion that was filed last week by the state. And they both seem like pretty strong suspects. They are waiting on more DNA evidence to be returned. There's testing that hasn't been completed, but I think they anticipate that'll happen in the next month or two.
Are these people that we know if we follow the case, or are they new?
If you know the case well enough, you probably would be able to recognize at least one of the suspects. Mm-hmm. The other one is unlikely. I don't think anybody ever considered this other person a suspect before. But having said that, I've also been asked not to publicly speculate mm-hmm. on or you know, name who I mm-hmm. believe are the suspects. Mm-hmm. One of them, I think, is pretty clear. But, I mean, for them to name these suspects in a motion, they're not putting all their cards on the table. There is going to be much more evidence that they are holding on to. And it could be just based on that evidence alone, with or without the DNA, they're able to make an arrest.
About Adnan now. Adnan is on house arrest for now. He's now partly back in the world. Is this weird for him?
I mean, honestly, he is partly back in the world. I don't know if it's weird for him. The last couple of days when we talked, he just sounds happy. And he is on home monitoring. He has an ankle bracelet. He's going to have that up until the state's attorney decides to either take him back to trial or drop charges, which will happen within 30 days. You know, when we talked about all kinds of things, but I never got a chance to ask him, how did you feel when you walked out of the courthouse and saw the reaction? And he's...
What was the reaction?
Oh, it was mayhem. Mm-hmm. It was just, you know, hundreds of people screaming their love and support and applauding for him and getting emotional thinking about it. It was incredible. It was exactly what I hoped for and envisioned. And when we went to his house, I mean, his house is right down the road from the mosque. Everybody in the community, people who knew him since he was born but hadn't seen him in 23 years, came by for hours and hours and hours. People kept coming and bringing food and just loving on him. And it was wonderful. It was incredible.
He was in jail for 23 years. You devoted that much time to trying to get him out. Yeah, he was a friend of your younger brother. You knew the family. Why?
Why? Because I absolutely believed he was innocent. Because I saw the trial play out. I knew how egregious his defense was, how many ways his defense attorney had failed. I was shocked and horrified by what I witnessed in the courtroom. But also because I always thought about one thing. If not me, then who? Because his family just didn't have the capability to deal with this. And if not me, he's going to die in prison. Am I okay with walking away and saying, Adnan, I have a life, I have a job. I never, ever worked as his attorney. I had a full-time career doing other things always. I went through a divorce, you know, being a single parent. I had life. But I kept thinking, if I say I can't do it anymore, that means he dies in prison. Am I okay with that? And I just couldn't be okay with that.
Rabia, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Brooke. I really appreciate your time and coverage of this story.
Rabia Chaudhry is an attorney, author, podcast host, and criminal justice reform advocate. Her podcast is called Undisclosed, and her memoir, Fatty Fatty Boom Boom, a memoir of food, fat, and family, is out November 8th. And that's the show. On the Media is produced by Micah Loewinger, Eloise Blondio, Molly Schwartz, Rebecca Clark Callender, Candace Wong, and Suzanne Gaber, with help from Tammy George. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Andrew Dunn. Katya Rogers is our executive producer. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.